Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Second Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis. Take number 6. Speaker, Dr. Donald W. Mulder.
Nice. We get on with this evening's entertainment. There are a couple of announcements. Does this thing project badly? Does it project now? Can you hear back there? Back there? Okay. A couple of announcements. One, before we get on with any business, I think we owe a round of applause, of appreciation for the woman who served dinner. They are the secretaries and various people who work here. Oh, I'm sorry. And Mike. And before she gets away, a round of applause for Marge Smith, who has done everything to make this conference possible. I was told that the swimming pool, which is sort of one of the unique features here at Warm Springs, will be open in the evenings. And for anybody who would like to take a dip, it is open and available. The water is 88 degrees. It may be chlorinated, I'm not sure. If people didn't bring bathing suits, we may have to work out a boy's turn and a girl's turn. But I'm told it's a... And then a Swedish, then there'll be a Swedish hour. But I'm told it's a unique experience. The only difficulty is that there are a number of submerged treatment tables. So diving is not encouraged. The other thing is, if you do go in, would you please take a person with you, so there's you have a buddy, because there is no institute personnel down there at this time of the day. And we want to avoid any problems of liability. At this time, I'd like to turn the proceedings over to Dr. Munsat, who's going to introduce this evening's speaker. Ted?
It's indeed a very great personal honor to introduce the speaker for this evening, Dr. Donald Mulder. Dr. Mulder was born in New Mexico, but in fact is a child of the Midwest. He went to college at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, attended Marquette University Medical School, did his residency at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, spent a period of time in the United States Navy, and then had his first academic appointment as assistant professor of neurology at the University of Colorado. Shortly thereafter, he went to the Mayo Clinic and was called back into service during the Korean War when he spent a year, I believe, on Guam. And it was this experience on Guam that triggered his great interest in the neuromuscular diseases in general, and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis specifically. Dr. Mulder then returned to the Mayo Clinic and began a brilliant career in clinical neurology and in neuromuscular diseases. He's one of the few people who has been able to take information gained from careful bedside evaluations and from listening to patients and to develop new concepts into how to approach neuromuscular diseases. He did this with ALS, and as we all know, he did it with the post-polio syndrome. In Japan, country that the Mulders have visited frequently and dearly love, they have a tradition of appointing certain individuals who have made major contributions to society as a national heritage. It's not the exact word I'm looking for, but as national institutions, people identified as such. I think we in neuromuscular disease would very much like to appoint Don as a national institution in neuromuscular disease. We're all greatly indebted to him and his lovely wife, and are very privileged, Don, to have you give this evening's address.
Thank you, Ted. It's really a very great pleasure and a very great privilege to be here, particularly in Warm Springs. Any of us who took care of polio patients during the great epidemic know that this place was a shining light for our patients. It was a place they all looked to, and it meant to them that there was hope. And to us as physicians, we knew that because of this place, our patients had hope not only for now, but for the future. Because we know that people who were here had become successful, such as FDR. I'm not going to tell you anything very new this evening. All of you know really what I'm going to say, but I just like to repeat some of the things which we all think about. I'm going to do it as an after-dinner speech. I know that Sybil Cole presented it much better earlier today, but I'll try to follow her example. As you probably know, patients paralyzed by polio develop convictions about themselves and their illness, which help them to adapt to their disability. They spent months in group rehabilitation, which sometimes initiated and always reinforced these beliefs. These convictions were initially believed by our patients because they were earnestly hoped for. These convictions often remained unchanged long after the acute illness was gone. Our recognition of these beliefs or these convictions will aid us in understanding and treating individuals with the sequelae of polio we've been discussing. This presentation will be a description of some of those beliefs as seen by one observer. It is not intended to be a scientific essay, but rather a series of anecdotes with reference to fables, poetry, history, and other literature where indicated. The acute epidemics of polio in the fourth and fifth decade of this century are still vivid in my memory. I began taking care of polio patients in 1943, but intensively only in the epidemics of 52 and 53. In preparation for this talk, I reviewed the autobiographies of many patients, letters from many others, in addition to biographies of famous patients who incidentally had poliomyelitis. Those who wrote these autobiographies may be unrepresentative of the majority of polio patients. The authors were individuals who were severely ill but did not die of their illness, and in spite of severe weakness, compensated and successfully adapted. Many of them had previously been writers or had literary help available to them. The biographies, of course, include many who are well known for reasons other than their illness. However, it is probable that the patients in these biographies and autobiographies are like the individuals who come to our examining rooms and whom we are discussing at this symposium. Patients who, in spite of severe disabilities, made a partial recovery and compensated surprisingly well for many years. This, then, will be a synthesis of my personal experience, patients' descriptions of the effects of polio, and the interpretation of biographers on the meaning of polio to their subjects. The patients with polio, of course, had the usual concern of individuals with severe paralyzing diseases. I'll only mention some of these briefly. The panic and unpredictable and severe illness brings, particularly when it may lead to death or disfigurement. The anxiety which paralysis, with its total dependence on others for all bodily needs, occasions. And society's anxiety during these epidemics, which accompanied the public hysteria surrounding the epidemics, it was exaggerated by those strange, stringent isolations we put the poor patients into who were affected. In addition to these well-known observations, I would like to stress three additional responses which were often reported by my patients and recur repeatedly in the biographies and autobiographies of polio patients, and I believe continue to affect the individual's responses today. A significant set of beliefs were related to the patient's struggle to compensate for their disabilities. They wrote about this in a variety of ways. One patient wrote, "We have a slowly forming new attitude to life in the world." Another wrote, "We have to learn to compensate gradually for what we do not have by what we have." Again, another wrote, "I had somehow to encompass with my mind the limitations of my body." This attempt to attain maximum function, both physically and psychologically, took many years for most patients and tremendous emotional and physical effort. The patient's attainments were often accompanied by the belief that anything was possible if only you tried. Many patients have continued their almost superhuman struggles throughout their lives and have, as you know, become spectacular overachievers in our society. A related belief held by patients who did compensate was that they could only recover. For example, one patient wrote, "Once the initial attack is over, there is no question of the sufferer's becoming worse. Always we improve, and the chances are that we shall regain 100% mobility." Another wrote, "The only direction a patient can move is towards improvement, and perhaps complete recovery. This belief in recovery was usually accompanied by a belief that it was an individual spirit which allowed recovery." One patient wrote, "Just keep trying to strengthen your muscles and you too will walk." Another wrote, "This improvement is a thrilling thing, and although it may be a natural process, you can't help feeling that your personal contributions are not small." Associated with this belief in recovery, there was often a partial denial of the extent of the patient's disability by both the patient and his family. The medical team often initiated and encouraged many of these beliefs. Equally important for us as physicians who care for these individuals with polio sequelae was the response of the patient to the confusion of the attending physicians during the initial illness. This confusion often significantly interfered with the recovery of the patient and with treatment. Many patients were initially misdiagnosed or mismanaged. One patient wrote, "Thus I ran into for the first time that difference of opinion between doctors, of which I was to see a great deal. Granted that medicine is an art as much as a science, by what signs is a patient to know which doctor is a better artist?" Another patient wrote, "The extent of bracing depends on which orthopedist is on duty this month. Treatment or lack of treatment depended on the geographic locality in which the patient lived and the physician he chose." The patient thus became skeptical about the medical establishment very early in his illness. This distrust was often aggravated by prolonged hospitalization, which permitted the patient to witness the errors and human foibles of the best of our medical institutions. This distrust of physicians continues to be present in the patients with a post-polio sequelae. The reverse of this skepticism is seen in the universal belief of polio patients in four legendary entities for them: Sister Kenny, Franklin Roosevelt, the National Foundation, and of course the only one remaining, Warm Springs. Before turning to a discussion of the patient's biographies and autobiographies, it is appropriate to review what the diagnosis and treatment of polio was in the middle of this century, a period during which patients now coming to our examining rooms were affected. Specific therapies, and there were very many of them, reminds me, Ted, of the therapies for ALS right now. The specific therapies included such drugs as strychnine, prostigmine, uricoline, curare, cobra venom, various antibiotics, and of course many others. some of these preparations were used intrathecally. Reports of their efficacy were based on anecdotal information, but were held with certitude by their proponents. I found no attempt to do double-blind studies on any of these medications. It's interesting, X-ray therapy also had wide use. It was given both to the muscles and the spinal cord. Most patients received, however, heat, massage, and exercise. In this century, the fad became to use splints and to cast patients. In fact, large depositories of splints were held in central locations and made available for epidemics. Paralyzed patients were often laid in a posterior plaster body cast, which made it impossible for them to move for months at a time and resulted, of course, in a loss of muscle tone. Another cast was made for their anterior surface so they could be turned periodically. Orthopedic surgery was used extensively. Fixing joints, lengthening and shortening extremities, and transferring muscles. Some patients remembered spending every summer in orthopedic hospitals where such surgery was carried on indeterminately. I believe that the patients who had already spent much of their young lives in hospitals often defensively went on to medical or paramedical vocations, as you know. Diagnosis was often overlooked in sporadic cases, while during epidemics, it was common to find much overdiagnosis. Paralysis of any kind, those secondary to strokes, brain tumors, Guillain-Barré syndromes, multiple sclerosis, and many others were, in my experience, called polio. This overdiagnosis was abetted by the financial support the National Foundation gave polio patients. Thus, the diagnosis of poliomyelitis was associated with significant secondary gain in the 50s. It's interesting that, someone turn on the lights, the projector for me maybe? Interestingly, kind of the turn of this situation happened when a partially trained nurse in the 30s found in her isolated Australian community that polio patients responded best to a simpler treatment. She advocated for the paralysis of polio warm, moist heat applied in wool packs in early activity. This was contrary, of course, to much of the medical treatment then in vogue. Sister Kenny, the Australian nurse, was rebuffed repeatedly by the medical profession, and she rebuffed them a bit too. She was a great fighter. And she turned her observations into a worldwide crusade for the treatment of patients. Her crusade was conducted largely in the newspapers, and an interesting description of it can be found in Victor Cohn's book, Sister Kenny, the Woman Who Challenged the Doctors. This is another picture of her. The controversy about her treatment in Australia and later worldwide contributed a great deal of attention to the disease and, of course, added a great deal to the confusion about its treatment. In retrospect, it is clear that Sister Kenny made a number of positive achievements. She substituted optimistic activity in the treatment of polio patients for immobilization. And she recognized clearly and stated repeatedly and forcibly that when you put a limb into a splint, it lost its function, a condition she called alienation. And one of her problems was, of course, that she used her own words. She used alienation instead of disuse, as we would use, and the doctors wouldn't give up, and she wouldn't give up, so they couldn't agree with each other. With it all, Sister Kenny was a feisty person who, one observer noted, would continue to fight long after you were agreeing with her. In 1940, she moved to the United States after having been rejected by medical authorities both in England and in Australia. An interesting comment on what medical therapy was like in the United States in 1951 can be found in a description by an Irish physician, Dr. McSweeney, who visited many of the leading polio centers in the United States in 1951 and reported to his colleagues what he had learned. He reported, surprisingly, and I hadn't known of this, that tracheotomy was being used as a curative therapy for any bulbar symptoms. This was, however, dying out, he reported, in the East Coast. But on the West Coast, over 50% of the patients who had any bulbar symptoms at all had a trach done. On the East Coast, the percentage was down to 6%, he reported, and he thought this was probably much closer to what was right. He also noted that extensive surgery was being done very early in a few centers, orthopedic surgery, but he stated the results weren't very impressive with that. He was, however, impressed with Sister Kenny's treatment. He stated, however, that in those places where it was most orthodoxly used, he reported that they would change the moist, hot wool packs at 170 degrees every hour or two throughout the day. And I'll have to ask Mary Codd whether this is true, but Mary tells me that he's reported that he didn't think that Irish patients would put up with such tremendous heat. It's kind of interesting in talking to people more recently. I hadn't thought about that. One of the people who I know quite well who had polio says that she can still remember them wheeling that tank of hot pack in to put the hot packs on her, and she observed that the attendant didn't reach down with her hand to get them, but reached down with a pair of pliers to get them out and put them on the skin directly. She said it was very, very painful. He, however, felt that Sister Kenny's aversion to He felt also that Sister Kenny's aversion to hydrotherapy and respirators seemed ill-founded. In fact, she was so much opposed to hydrotherapy that she thought that here at Warm Springs it would be better if they filled the pool with dirt and put a rose garden in, that this would be better for the patients. She was not given to very charitable remarks. He maintained that she had done a very great deal, but that unfortunately this was not stated in the medical literature, although it was reported in the newspapers. He finally summarized his American experience for his Irish colleagues by stating that he felt the best treatment was a modification of Sister Kenny's therapy with the use of hydrotherapy and hot packs as needed. He also thought early mobilization was indicated and that surgery should be avoided for at least several years. For me, reading the biographies and autobiographies of the polio patients vividly brought back to me my early polio experience. I have chosen this evening to discuss three patients for whom we have available more than one biography and who are historical figures to illustrate certain universal attitudes in these patients as I found them in my reading. The earliest of these is the first Earl of Shaftesbury. He lived from 1621 to 1683 and is reported to have had a polio-crippled body. He was a very small man, and paintings of him do suggest that one arm at least was small and might be polio-weak. He is of particular interest to me because he was one of the initial proprietors of Prince Rupert Land and a deputy governor of that land, which included much of Minnesota. He also, you may be interested to know, was a proprietor of the Carolina Grant, and thus and a deputy governor of that grant, which includes Warm Springs here. So he was both a proprietor of Minnesota and of Georgia, and that simultaneously. He, like many polio patients with residual weakness, was an amazing overachiever. His adaptation to what was a profound muscular weakness was remarkable. He reports that early in life, when he attended Oxford at Exeter College, he frequently bested the fellows at Christ Church in disputation. But he found he had a problem because the people there tended, when they lost the intellectual argument, to go to fisticuffs. I don't know if this still goes on there or not. But he wrote that for this reason he took always with him three sturdy country fellows to help him out at such a situation. Initially, he was a supporter of Charles I, prominent actually in his government. Later, somehow or another, he became to be a supporter of Cromwell. And still later, he was one of those who brought Charles II back as King of England and was prominent in his government. Eventually, when Prince Rupert died, he fled to Holland. Lord Shaftesbury was, in spite of his weakness, an overachiever. His diagnosis is far from certain, as Mary Codd will tell you. But this is a problem I believe we have to contend with, not only for him, but for many of the patients we see. We must rely on reports which are many years old. Rarely are we given definitive virus studies, and even spinal fluid reports are infrequent. Even during the great epidemics, The diagnosis was dependent on a clinical history, and examination was confirmed by a spinal fluid examination, which was often inadequate. We know a great deal more about Sir Walter Scott's illness, and he really has written very beautifully about it. And we know particularly about the confusion of his doctors. I would like to quote from his description of it as recorded in Lockhart's Life of Scott. He said, "When I was about 18 months of age, I was affected with a fever. After several days, it was noted that I had lost the use of my right leg. When the efforts of regular physicians had been exhausted, my parents eagerly grasped at every prospect of cure. Among the odd remedies to aid my lameness, someone had recommended that so often as a sheep was killed, I should be stripped and swathed up in the skin, warm as it was flayed from the carcass of the animal." It's rather interesting. One of his first memories is being wrapped up in this skin and having his grandfather in an old cock hat and some kind of a military uniform on the ground with him, trying to encourage him to crawl after him by pulling his watch in front of him. But when this didn't work too well, my grandfather, in addition, had advised that I should be sent to reside in the country. There I was usually carried out and laid down beside the old shepherd among the rocks and crags around which he fed the sheep. The impatience of a child soon inclined me to struggle with my infirmity, and I began by degrees to stand, to walk, and to run. Although the limb remained shrunken and contracted, I was now a sturdy child. This centuries-old treatment recorded by Scott, consisting, as you can hear, of hot packs and early exercise, sounds very similar to that of Sister Kenny. Is it possible that too much education had defrauded physicians early in this century of knowledge previously widely known? In Warm Springs, polio and Franklin Delano Roosevelt are synonymous. I know many of you saw the movies of him today. He initially came here in 1924, and he bought this place in 1926 because he thought it was so helpful to him. The facts about his polio are well known. He's written a letter, which is about it, explaining in some detail. In the summer of 1921, when he was 39 years old, he contracted a severe illness while vacationing at a summer home on an island off New Brunswick. The illness was originally diagnosed as a blood clot on the spinal cord. Examination revealed his legs were paralyzed, his arms were weak, and on at least one occasion he was delirious. I found no evidence that he had a spinal fluid examination. After 2 weeks, the diagnosis was changed to poliomyelitis, and he was brought to New York City and hospitalized. 5 months after the acute episode, he had developed contractures of both knees and the right foot, which were treated with plaster casts. He spent the entire period from 1921 to 1928 learning how to encompass the physical limitations of his body and the psychological limitations. He specifically spent a great deal of time attempting to relearn to walk, much of that here at Warm Springs. He writes that when he first came here in 1923, he could stand in the water only when it was to his chin. He was very impressed because in 6 months he could stand in the water to the top of his shoulders. In 6 months more, he found that he could stand to the water to his armpits. And I presume this was the level, the limit of his recovery. In 1928, after great effort, he learned to simulate walking with the use of braces and a cane while holding on to someone's arm. And as you can see, what he would do in a situation such as this is in a hotel lobby when he's running for a governor, I think, he would lurch from one side to the other using his upper body to simulate walking. He used this athletic feat whenever he appeared in public for almost the rest of his life. Perhaps the most instructive analysis of the development of his new beliefs and adaptations which enabled him to live so successfully are found in the book edited by Gallagher entitled The Splendid Deception. I know Mr. Gallagher was here last year. He himself had paralytic polio with residual weakness of both legs and was treated here at Warm Springs. Thus, he is unusually well qualified to help us understand Roosevelt's adaptation. The book title, as you can see, is really quite provocative, The Splendid Deception. As you can see, the people who published the book suggest the people who are being deceived is the public. But if that were so, that must have been that the public wished to be deceived. No pictures, of course, were allowed of him in a wheelchair, except for one or two which Gallagher were able to find. At least that's the official word. There are very few pictures of him available being carried. Yet this was a common method for him to be transferred from one place to another. The public must have been willingly deceived. Many individuals helped to carry him in the White House, on his weekly fishing trips, on his frequent political trips. I've gathered a number of those pictures, which one can find, I think, everywhere in the community where people saw Roosevelt. This is, for example, a speech he gave in Rochester, Minnesota in 1934. And you can see that there were a lot of people there. It was a time when everybody was concerned about polio. Here was the president with polio. There were thousands of people gathered to see him. And I've had some eyewitnesses report to me what they've seen. The official picture that came from that scene is a kind of official picture that always was shown of Roosevelt sitting. You can see he's here with the two male brothers. And this was a kind of official picture which was passed around. But if you were there, what you would have seen is the president coming out to the back of his observatory car, as he did out on that deck there, all over the country. He would appear at the door. People who were witnessing it would tell me that the door would open and he would come out with his son, and he would lurch out onto that, out to the edge of the platform, and everyone could see clearly that this man was very severely paralyzed. When he got up on the stage, as you can see, his son would have brought him to this point with his cane, and there he is, holding on for dear life, and everybody could see that clearly who was standing in the audience. And if you look behind him, you can see that he wears his trousers just a little longer than the average to cover his braces. But again, of course, the braces are visible. And here again is a picture of him standing in front. And again, I think it's very clear that the person, anybody in that audience, couldn't help but be aware that this was a man who was very severely crippled by polio. One of my friends who has very severe polio was at this meeting. He had trouble in his legs, and he wondered how they got the president around. So he went out behind to see what happened, and he saw them carry Roosevelt down, and they brought him down as they did every day in his life. He must have gone this way. They carried him to the car, stood him up next to the car, and he fell backwards, as you can see, into the car. Somebody leans down to undo his braces, and then he scoots into the back seat. This scene, of course, must have been seen by thousands of people in this country. This picture, however, reminds me of one other thing that came to my mind as I looked at it. It reminds me more of the fable, if you may remember, of Hans Christian Andersen, the fable in which the emperor has no clothes. And the emperor has a new suit of clothes. He actually doesn't have, but he thinks he has all of his people who are with him, official people, think he does. He goes out in the community and they all say together, look at the emperor's new clothes. But if you look down there, you'll see that little boy who's standing there, just as in the emperor's story, he sees that the emperor really can't walk. He's probably the only one. So I think this was kind of a mutual deception, an agreed to deception in the country, and that Roosevelt was as much involved in the deception, and he was deceiving himself as much as he was anyone else. Gallagher, too, suggests that FDR was also deceiving himself. All of us create and recreate images of ourselves with which we can live, and we often deceive ourselves. A person with severe physical handicap may be unable to accept himself with his disability and projects another image which is more pleasing to himself. I believe that Roosevelt, as many other polio patients have, did this. The image which Roosevelt projected included standing and walking. This is really the picture he liked best, this kind of a scene. And you can see that's really quite a physical affair to be able to stand like that for any length of time. Missy LaHand, his secretary and confidant, reported that he always believed that if he had just spent another year here at Warm Springs, he would have learned how to walk with a single brace and without the aid of the cane or the arm assist. It is recorded that he reviewed an article about himself while he was president, prior to its publication in the magazine Liberty. It was apparent to those with him that the article upset him greatly, and they suspected he must be concerned about comments about his presidency. However, when he finished the article, he slammed the manuscript down and stated, "This magazine says I've never completely recovered from infantile paralysis." Never recovered? I have only never recovered the full use of my knees. Correct that. It is true that he no longer had acute infantile paralysis, but even the most casual observer saw that he had severe muscle weakness, which included much more than his knees. In his later years, he had increasing difficulties. In his final speech to Congress in March of 1945, when he reported on the Yalta Conference, he spoke in Congress for the first time sitting rather than standing. He had previously stood for such formal speeches, even though he had to be carried to the lectern. In the last year, he had difficulty lighting a cigarette, holding a cup of coffee, and driving a car because his hands also became weaker. Surely these were all symptoms of increasing disability, and they probably were related to his increasing activity, to his hypertension, and to his congestive heart failure. The deception Gallagher spoke of included even those close to him, who apparently didn't really realize the severity of his disability. Gallagher reports that FDR complained to his wife in the last year that he could not live out a normal lifespan, stating, "I can't even walk across the room to get to my circulation." He himself was perhaps referring to that ancient poet who over 2,500 years ago wrote that the length of our days is 70 years, or 80 if we have the strength. And Roosevelt was suggesting that with his strength, he'd be lucky to reach 60. Mrs. Roosevelt, however, interpreted his progressive symptoms as psychologic, writing to a friend that Franklin was giving way to invalidism. As you know, he died here April 12, 1945. The biographies and autobiographies I have reviewed suggest to me that many patients who successfully adapted to severe disability from polio have done so with the aid of firmly held convictions which were established during their convalescence. These convictions, which were invaluable to the patient who was young and vigorous, became a liability when aging and progressive weakness occur. The patient who has adapted to his weakness through great physical and emotional effort finds that he can no longer deny he is increasingly unable to carry out activities he previously found possible. The psychologic impact of this awareness has been devastating to many of our patients. They cannot believe that they are not continuing to improve and become concerned there is something wrong with their spirit. They may consult their physicians, but most of them know that in the past, physicians have been wrong or even wrong-headed about polio and its treatment. They feel abandoned by the medical profession. Attendance at this symposium, for me, is not only an honor, but carries a particular responsibility to patients who have paralytic polio. Warm Springs remains a shrine to patients who had polio. Here in Warm Springs, we speak ex cathedra. We should clearly and authoritatively define the cause of the post-polio sequelae we are discussing and outline its treatment. The patients with post-polio sequelae have in the past adapted to an overwhelming physical catastrophe. I am certain that if they understand the cause of their increasing symptoms and a mode of treatment, they will continue to adapt successfully. Thank you.
This is the end of tape 6 and concludes this portion of the program.